We have two fellows joining us. I don't know if Paul is on yet. I didn't see him a few seconds ago. Paul Wavercrow is our new pulmonary pathology fellow in Arizona. So we're delighted to have him. It looks like there he is.
Morning.
All right, Paul, good morning. And then we have Julian from Rochester, who's had a great month down here. I think he might.
I'm here. Just my camera doesn't work. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's all right. All right. So you're in transit or are you in Arizona yet?
I am in Rochester already. Okay, that's here in Hilton 11.
All right. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for presenting. So Julian, I think I put your article first in here. Oh, no, I didn't. I put Paul's in. So Paul, why don't you go ahead? You're going to talk about CPFE.
Sure.
If you want to share your screen, you can do that. Or if you want me to bring up the summary you wrote, it's up to you.
Oh, yeah, that would be great, actually, if you could bring up my summary.
All right.
Thank you. So thank you for having me. Long time listener, first time caller, I think is the expression here. So I've listened to these journal clubs for quite some time. I'm presenting the paper titled Syndrome of Combined Pulmonary Fibrosis and Emphysema, an official ATS, ERS, JRS, ALAT research statement. And I'll just be referring to it as CPFE for the most part from this point forward. So having been a longtime listener, I know better than to show up strongly endorsing any paper. So I apologize to Dr. Myers if he's in attendance as one of the authors, if my feelings towards the paper seem a bit cynical or skeptical. The background to this research statement is that the term CPFE has been used to describe a clinical scenario with, as the name implies, the presence of both emphysema and fibrotic interstitial lung disease in the same patient. The authors state in the introduction that the term has clinical significance, but is poorly understood. My suspicion is that maybe one author in particular holds this view, that the term has clinical significance, but I'm not sure it's as widely accepted as they suggest. So the historical milestones are around CPFE are presented in table one in the paper. The first case apparently was in 1948, which they describe a 27-year-old woman with IPF, apparently. So whatever that actually was, I don't know. The term was officially coined in 2005 in a paper by Cotin, who's my prime suspect for the individual pushing this term. Which was a retrospective study of 61 patients with CPFE, where he suggested individualizing CPFE as an entity. And then he published another paper in 2009 suggesting to make it a syndrome. So, you know, here we are 13 years later, kind of wondering what this entity is and still making the case. So it's interesting to note that there are a few pathology papers listed amongst the CPFE milestones, including the first papers on RBIL-ILD with fibrosis by Dr. Yusum, airspace enlargement with fibrosis by Dr. Kawabata, and smoking-related interstitial fibrosis by Dr. Katzenstein. Although I have some trouble recognizing whether these histologic pathologic findings directly relate to CPFE. The method behind this research statement was to gather a committee, including 19 pulmonologists, 5 radiologists, and 3 pathologists, and assess all the data from past studies over the past 20 years, articles describing cases of patients with both emphysema and pulmonary fibrosis. In the end, they gathered a total of 96 papers and accumulated the findings from that, which was presented in long paper, kind of describing all the features. So I'll go through some of them. The epidemiological findings are presented in table 2. Notable findings include the wide range of prevalence, cited as anywhere from 8 to 67% in patients with IPF, obviously quite a wide range. Their explanation being that maybe genetics, smoking rates, or just definitions of CPFE could account for that wide range. The prevalence in the general population is somewhat unknown. They kind of make reference to a few CT screening studies to give some vague idea. Etiological associations are listed in table 3, which includes cigarette smoking and male sex. I don't know if that's really an etiological association, but notable that CPFE occurs 9 times more frequently in males. Also notable that although almost all patients report a history of smoking. There are exceptions to that, which includes patients with connective tissue disease or fibrotic HP. CPFE can also occur in non-smokers, especially in the context of CTD. For example, in a study with 116 patients with rheumatoid arthritis-associated ILD who were never smokers, emphysema was found in around 25%, and the implication being that those 25% would have CPFE. Also worth noting that emphysema occurs in, they say, 7 to 23% of patients with fibrotic HP, again, supporting this concept that emphysema may not be entirely smoking related in this study or in their findings. Regarding clinical manifestations and comorbidities, patients with CPFE have a mean age of 65 to 70, similar to COPD and IPF. The two most predominant comorbidities include lung cancer and pulmonary hypertension. There's a fair bit of information provided regarding lung function studies summarized in table four, but notable that patients with CPFE often have relatively preserved airflow rates and lung volumes, but impaired DLCO and transfer coefficient. So that particular clinical finding from what I've read might be the reason for pushing for this term so that it's a recognized pattern clinically, and differing from the usual lung functions of IPF patients. Also, they note that patients with IPF are monitored using forced vital capacity at 1 second, but that's not a reliable indicator or measure for tracking disease progression in CPFE. So an argument again being made that there's something peculiar about this scenario with CPFE warranting designating as an entity so that clinicians would know not to track a patient with that. There's a long section covering imaging features of CPFE, including figures 1 through 9. A few points are worth mentioning. One is that distinguishing admixed cysts from honeycomb change can be difficult on imaging. And secondly, and this will come up again a little bit during the pathology, there's this imaging description of thick-walled cystic lesions in some cases of CPFE, where it's areas of admixed fibrosis and emphysema. And the theorized mechanism of formation in that is that the expansion of emphysema by contraction of fibrotic lung, which they've suggested using the term traction emphysema, given the similar mechanism of formation to traction bronchiectasis. They mentioned that it's unknown whether these thick wall cysts are specific for CPFE. Regarding the pathology, there's a nice description of smoking-related pathology, including RB, smoking-related interstitial fibrosis, and Langerhans cell histiocytosis. It's noted that the pathologic patterns of fibrosis seen in patients with CPFE are heterogeneous. As the coexistence of emphysema and fibrotic ILD can be seen in biopsies, it's suggested that pathologists need to document the presence of both when they see both findings. UIP is the most commonly reported pattern of pulmonary fibrosis in patients with CPFE. Other less commonly described patterns include fibrotic NSIP and DIP. Oddly, although it's mentioned in other parts of the paper, fibrotic HP is not mentioned in the pathology section. But I did notice actually in the supplemental notes on the radiological findings that in their cases, from the reviews in their cases of CPFE, in the radiological findings, they said that the findings were basal predominant in 100% of cases. So I'm not really sure how many cases of actual HP were mixed in there. It's noted that CPFE cannot be diagnosed based on histopathology alone, but that supportive features include a combination of emphysema and a pattern of fibrosis other than smoking-related interstitial fibrosis or Langerhans cell histiocytosis. So those are considered or not adequate for fibrosis or don't meet criteria, I suppose. Although the authors do state that smoking-related interstitial fibrosis has not been established as a cause of CPFE, however, they purport that these thick-walled cysts, as you see in figure 13, could be a unique histologic feature and describe them as a combination of smoking-related interstitial fibrosis and emphysema. So even though smoking-related interstitial fibrosis isn't considered one of the patterns of fibrosis in CPFE, it's a part of this particular histologic finding. So it's a little peculiar to me. The authors also state in the paper that smoking-related interstitial fibrosis or airspace enlargement with fibrosis may represent a unique histopathologic pattern of CPFE. And I'm not really sure what to make of that, meaning it sounds like they're saying that that would only be seen in cases of CPFE. So I thought that was odd. The authors speculate that the poor prognosis of CPFE may be related to the presence of pulmonary hypertension. They note that vascular changes are more extensive in CPFE and IPF than in emphysema alone, which I don't think would seem like a huge surprise to us. And that's based on histopathology. So the proposed definitions of CPFE can be seen in Table 11. The research definition is entirely based on a high-res CT confirming the presence of emphysema involving at least 5% of the lung by volume and lung fibrosis of any subtype. And so that's a more easy to satisfy criteria meant to kind of gather cases to do research. The classification criteria are intended to have clinical relevance and are more exclusive. And they add the requirement of emphysema involving at least 15% of total lung volume as opposed to 5%, in addition to criteria based on lung function and or the presence of pulmonary hypertension. Although pathology isn't included in diagnostic criteria, there's an asterisk noting that CPFE is suggested if lung biopsies show emphysema and any pattern of pulmonary fibrosis, which would then trigger radiological evaluation and quantifying the amount of emphysema to possibly meet the criteria for diagnosis. So, and in the end, the authors end up spending a fair bit of time making a case that CPFE should be considered a syndrome. The main points presented in Table 12. And kind of in summary, you know, from reviewing this article, I think from a clinical perspective, there may be some utility in defining the syndrome for diagnostic and management purposes. I'm a bit skeptical that it actually represents something unique and that there's anything that would ever come from pursuing this line of research in terms of uncovering anything insightful about pathogenesis related to fibrosis and or emphysema. And I would say it's probably useful that we are aware of what the term is. I know for myself clinically that I've had clinicians ask me, could this be CPFE? And I kind of look at cases and go, you know, well, yes, they have emphysema and fibrosis and didn't really know much about the syndrome beyond that. I don't think I'm going to be making necessarily the diagnosis based on tissue, but just a term that we should know for the purpose of communication with clinicians. So that is kind of it. So any questions?
Thank you, Paul. You know, for me, it was like you, I always thought, well, if we see some emphysema in the upper lobe and then the fibrosis in the lower lobe and the patient was a smoker, that would kind of count for CPFE, and that usually was confirmed by radiology. What I found interesting is that they included cases with, or that you apparently can see it in cases with rheumatoid arthritis. I didn't really think about that as a disease related with emphysema.
Yeah, like I said, they've included fibrotic HP and fibrotic NSIP, and so there's all like any sort of fibrosis accepted, other than as I was saying, smoking related interstitial fibrosis. So that's going to be quite a diverse group of patients, kind of under this umbrella diagnosis. And as I said, I think maybe there's some clinical utility in management from a physiological standpoint, but etiologically, I don't really understand the purpose of grouping these patients together.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me as well, although patients who tend to get fibrosis in the setting of RA tend to be the cigarette smokers. So, you know, it kind of gets muddy in there, I guess.
And
it also seems a bit unclear. I mean, classic descriptions of SRIF and, you know, airspace enlargement with fibrosis generally are that those are asymptomatic background findings in cigarette smokers. I mean, that's how Anna presented her series and Kawabata as well. Sam's, it's a little bit unclear in Sam's paper on whether all those RBILD cases with fibrosis were symptomatic or not. It's a little bit unclear in how he described those. But nonetheless, it's interesting that they kind of include that in this group as well, even though we've been thought to think about those as incidental background findings. So maybe more to come on that.
One thing I want was, if this is joined, by the way, you know, SRIF, you know, the SRIF, what Anna described it was as a, you know, instant of finding in smokers. And her point was not to get confused with fibrosing NSIP. Now it is related to CPFE, which is much more serious disease, you know, which kind of worse, in a way, worse kind of IPF or UIP. So how, I mean, I read your summary and I probably better read the paper, but what do you take, what do you think on that?
Well, so as I kind of said, the like SRIF is not considered adequate to meet the criteria for fibrosis. It's not a pattern of fibrosis that's considered the fibrosis part of CPFE, but it seems to be an integral part in the, or it's a finding in these cases. They kind of describe it as a histologic finding, but that it doesn't meet the fibrosis component. But then it's also involved in this kind of unique thick-walled cyst lesion. So I'm a bit puzzled about, like, kind of looking at that image, whether it really is something that would identify.
I'm just asking, I'm saying, because, you know, you will see emphysema, and in a smoker, as an incidental finding, you will see that those collagen fibrosis in the subpleural lung tissue. So how do you go about that? Maybe that's practically a problem, you know, for us.
So anyway, I don't have an answer.
It makes sense that you would see, you know, SRIF, et cetera, in this setting. So maybe that's what they're saying, but I haven't read the entire paper either. And I appreciate Paul's, you know, summary of it. So it sounds like, though, they don't consider that enough. That's not the fibrosis that you can use to suggest CPFE, which I guess would imply that they don't think it's clinically significant.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is maybe getting to your point in mind, Joanne, about it still being a potential entity that's background pathology worth noting, but doesn't make it UIP, IPF, or any other fibrotic lung disease. All right, I think we probably better move on, unless somebody else, maybe one more question, comment?
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand the same thing. So my understanding is that as I read it, there are some papers describing SRIF with combined pulmonary fibrosis and emphysema. So those papers are ignored in this recommendation, or?
So because the pathology isn't considered sort of the diagnostic, the way that this entity is being diagnosed, I don't know what SRIF looks like on imaging, but to be included in the study, it would just require imaging findings of fibrosis and emphysema.
But I'm talking about imaging studies.
Okay, yeah. So anything that looks like fibrosis would be included. But what was kind of described, and the reason, like, there's a fair bit written on smoking-related stuff for pathology, including SRIF, but in terms of pathology findings. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So I just pulled up a paper differentiating smoking-related interstitial fibrosis SRIF from usual interstitial pneumonia UIP with emphysema using CT features based on pathologically proven cases.
Okay. So, yeah, so I didn't, in this paper, they did not list SRIF as an exclusion criteria for fibrosis outside of the pathology section. So in the radiological findings, they just kind of say that it's a heterogeneous group for a variety of reasons, but any cause of fibrosis would be accepted there. I didn't get the sense that SRIF would be excluded on imaging as one of the causes of fibrosis.
And I guess the other question would be according to the newer papers, could actually SRIF be symptomatic?
Well, I guess that's kind of what we're getting at. I don't think the term was meant to include symptomatic, but that wasn't the cause of the symptoms, right? Even though you could,
I understand Katzenstein's original paper, but just like RBILD, if you cannot explain the patient's symptoms with anything else but with the SRIF, then what are you gonna do?
I think I have one comment, quick comment. I know we have to keep.
Yeah, we do have to move on.
Yeah. There is a nice paper in the Blue Journal by Lynette Scholl of interstitial lung abnormality, which is a big thing in the pulmonary community right now. And she described an important number of SRIFs. So I think a SRIF may be just, you know, a continuum of a different spectrum that could be very mild, like an ILA, and it could be present in higher in a smoker with, you know, a more complicated disease. So I think, of course, we don't have time to discuss this, but I think it's something important to take into account, in my opinion. Okay, I think we should
need to move on, but thanks for the good discussion. Okay, Julian, you're up.
Yes, Paul, can you share my screen, please? Oh, it's Dr. Tassar who is, okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I just wanna, okay. Okay, so do you guys see my screen right now?
Yep.
Okay, so I am gonna talk today about a paper about artificial intelligence, and as you know, this is a hot topic right now, and it's something that I thought was important to define, because some people may start asking questions about this. So this was a paper done in Japan by Dr. Fukuoka and their colleagues, and they started the paper saying that, you know, there's poor reproducibility of ILD's diagnosis, and they wanted to develop a deep learning model that can predict pathological diagnosis and survival. And what I'm sharing is this figure 2 of the paper, which is key to understand the paper. It's mostly a methods paper more than a clinical paper. And they have different steps in which they created this model that it's pathology driven. And that's the most important thing. And all the cases that were included in this study were reviewed by one expert pulmonary pathologist and were discussed in multidisciplinary discussion with clinicians and radiologists. And the key feature of the model is that they use a training set of 53 cases that were patients with IPF, RALD, systemic sclerosis ILD, DAD, PPFE, organizing pneumonia, and sarcoid. And they have a whole slide images from these patients, and they tile them at 3 different magnifications. After they have all the tiles, they used a convolution neural network that automatically extracted the morphological features of all these tiles. And this is what I'm highlighting here. And that step didn't need a human. And then the algorithm itself created clusters of these tiles, like I am highlighting here in 3 and 4. And after the algorithm pre-classified these clusters, there was a human that integrated the clusters, and they reviewed the different clusters, and if the cluster look alike, they group them. And if they didn't look alike, they ignore them. So after this, the model created a classifier based on the pathologist call. And this classifier was used then in a different set of patients, consisting of 180 consecutive surgical lung biopsies, for which they have clinical data. So they use this model after they create the classifier to predict UIP diagnosis versus non-UIP, and also they to predict the overall survival of the cohort. So besides this, they did a different analysis, and this is important to know, is that they use a different analysis which the human didn't integrate the clusters. So they basically compare the model with the clusters integration and the pathologist call, which was called the mixture, versus the other model that didn't use the human. And finally, after doing all this analysis, they examine each historical feature that the model identified and put that in a Cox proportional hazard model to identify if there were any difference in survival regarding the presence of any of these findings. So I think the main figure of the paper is this, is that this receiver operating curve that I'm putting here, in which they show that the model was very accurate to identify UIP. And they have two different sets, you know, a validation set and a derivation set. And both of them were the area under the curve was higher than 0.8. And they say that the most important findings for prediction of UIP a diagnosis in the model were the presence of acellular fibrosis or the presence or absence of cellular interstitial pneumonia or NSIP pattern. And not surprisingly, you know, when UIP was diagnosed by the model, there was a decreased survival compared to non-UIP. And in their models, they also found that cases that have high number of fibroblastic foci, dense fibrosis, elastosis, or increased lymphocyte aggregation had a poor survival. So I think in the discussion, they talk that this is a pathology-centered model because it leaves room for the expert judgment in the creation of the model. And the model alone doesn't perform well without the pathologist. I forgot to say that. So the model that didn't use the pathologist, actually, it had really bad performance. It has an error under the curve of 0.5 or something like that. So they say that, you know, the pathologists are needed definitely to make them a better call. And in part of the paper, they actually don't talk much about the limitations, which I actually, I found many limitations, I have to say. But they say that the model may serve to approach all the different diseases in which you need imaging and pathology at the same time. So my comments, I feel that the model is as in all these AI papers, the model are as good as the data that you give and as the, in this case, as the, will be as the pathologist that is feeding the model. If you have a really expert pulmonary pathologist feeding the model, it will be likely that a model will perform well because it's gonna try to mimic what the pathologist is calling, in this case, a cluster integration. But I think something that I found interesting is that this model doesn't include any clinical or radiological data into account. And this is far from reality because as we all know, we use a lot of clinical data or pulmonary function tests or CT scans sometimes to suggest some nuances of non-UIP diagnosis, especially, I have to say. So this model doesn't include anything of that. So it's only based on histopathology. And the other thing that this paper is lacking, and I think is the most important thing, is that the paper did not correct for covariates when they did the survival analysis. And that means that they didn't correct for gender or for age or for comorbidities. And that may affect the UIP survival. And they're saying that the model is really good to detect survival. But of course, if you are not including covariates, this may be biased. And the other thing that I found that is important that is not in the paper is that there is no analysis of the spatial relationship between each findings. They don't talk about the location of fibrosis, if it's subpleural, airway center, et cetera. And you know that this is muddying a little bit the thing because they don't talk anything about HP, for example. And is it important to differentiate CHP or UAP? Well, I mean, that's a big question for a field, right? But they don't address that here. And I think the last limitation that I found is that I reviewed the cases that actually failed to be classified as UIP and were UIP. And I noticed that one case of acute exacerbation with UIP where acute exacerbation was classified wrongly. And it was the only case that it included. So I think the model didn't address this. If you have an acute process going in a new IP patient, it may fail. So that's something else to consider. And I think that's all what I have to discuss. Do you guys have any questions? Let me know.
So not ready for prime time yet?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there are a lot of advantages of using artificial intelligence, but you have to do the right studies. And I think this is a good study, but there are things I feel that, you know, including radiology or clinical data, it's tricky because a biopsy may be limited if you get a bad sample, right? And the other thing is that you have to address all these other factors that may affect survival. If you're going to evaluate survival, you have to include genders, comorbidities, sex, age, etc.
Yeah, any other thoughts, comments? Thanks. Yeah, I think your caveats were all well taken. I mean, it's a nice study. It's, you know, there have been a couple of studies like this now that have shown that, you know, you can identify all of those features, but I think putting them all together is still a challenge. And you know, loading in all the other radiologic data. I mean, I haven't seen a study like that you are saying is a limitation of this one.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you both. I'll quickly try to go through the last two articles and then highlight one or two other things. So the next paper is another sort of large guideline type paper, integrating clinical probability into the diagnostic approach to IPF, an international working group perspective. And there's a couple of pathologists on here. I know Jeff, I think, is on it. I'm not sure if there was anybody else. So they think that there's still a gap in the diagnosis of IPF, even though we have guidelines. And I think we're all aware of the fact that you could run patients through the HP guidelines and get a diagnosis of HP, and you could run the same patient through the IPF guidelines and get a diagnosis of IPF. So they tried to sort of correlate or deal with that issue. So they identified factors that influence the likelihood of a diagnosis of IPF. They looked at high, intermediate, and low probability, a pretest clinical probability. And then they integrated HRCT and pathology to come up with a post-test probability of a diagnosis of IPF. And mostly for time, I'll just show you the framework that they come up with, which is very similar to a lot of the other guideline papers that show boxes like this, and you put the patients in the box depending on where they fall. So this is the pathology pattern that's been incorporated, that's used, and then you incorporate that with the radiology and the clinical information to come up with these boxes, if you will. I thought that at the end of the day, they actually say the clinical assessment of probability of IPF as proposed does not substitute for expert clinical gestalt. In other words, you know, their gestalt is just as good as going through all of this. So a little bit like the CPFE paper, which I think has some other issues, that's where they landed. I think part of their intro states, however, that these guidelines could be useful for clinicians who don't see a lot of patients with IPF. And we all know that, you know, it seems as though from the consult practice that we still get cases of IPF where the clinical, at least from what we can see, all fits for a diagnosis of IPF, including the imaging, and yet we have a lung biopsy. So, you know, maybe there's still some utility to this. You might want to look at this paper, but I really appreciated I found that interesting that their overall gestalt, you know, was as good as following all of these guidelines. The next is a paper on, we've talked about these clear cell stromal tumors, and I'll just bring up one image of these. So this is kind of what they look like. If you get an SFT that doesn't seem to be standing like an SFT, perhaps you ought to think about one of these clear cell stromal tumors. The point of the article is, The point of the article was, A, these are really not benign tumors, and there have been a couple of papers or a couple of patients who have ended up with metastases from these. It also shows that there are a couple of different YAP fusions. These are often positive for TFE3, and some of them can have necrosis. So three patients had aggressive disease with these, and I think it's a growing family of tumors with TFE3 expression, including epithelial hemangiomas and cutaneous low-grade fibromyxoid sarcomas. So, I think the only way to get to these is to begin to run any tumor you don't clearly have a diagnosis for through next-gen sequencing. I'm assuming, and Jen, I see that you're on, you maybe have some comments. I'm assuming that this would be picked up on our panel, for example, or somebody else who knows our panel.
I would have to look, the YAP TFE, I would have to look. I think it's on there, but I don't know. I would have to double check.
Yeah, okay, all right, thanks.
Did they say anything about YAP1 expression, protein expression? Does that change? We do have a stain for it.
Hold on. I think, so yeah, they do. So here's one of their cases was diffusely positive for TFE3. So you have the immunostain.
Yeah, we do have TFE3 and we do have YAP1 or YAP as an immunostain.
Okay. Here's another one. Let me just look at their table a minute. Yeah, well, I had that in my table. So they all have diffuse TFE3 expression. So I guess that's maybe the way to get at it. I forgot that you had that. And I think we talked about that the last time somebody presented this topic. So it still is not in my brain. I guess that's why I thought I needed to present it. And I still need to get a handle on this, not having at least knowingly seen one of these.
What was scary for me is that it was some of them were TTF1 positive. One of them was TTF1 positive.
Yeah, I think they're tricky.
It does look like YAP and TFE are on in the sarcoma panel.
Okay, but maybe we can get there with immunohistochemistry as well, but I don't know enough about.
Well, TFE3 IHC, I think, has poor specificity. I mean, I think it can be positive in other things. I'm not sure about YAP1. The combination might be good. Anya would know more about that than me.
All right.
Well, I'm not so sure about that YAP1. For instance, I tried it in one of these metaplastic zymomas that apparently have the YAP1 MAMEL2 translocation. I didn't really see consistent results, but, we only had a few specimens. So I don't really know how YAP1 reacts in these gene fusions.
Are there any pearls from a histologic standpoint that anyone who's seen any of these can share?
I mean, Kelly, here's the way the initial diagnoses were: malignant spindle cell neoplasm, synovial sarcoma, Faber-Pacoma. As I looked at those images, that made me think a little bit, at least some of them made me think about kind of a funny SFT, like this one, to me looks like a funny SFT, and those stains are going to be negative, and then you're kind of left scratching your head. I don't know. Has anybody seen one of these?
Not that I knew when I saw it.
Right.
So, I don't remember seeing any of these. And besides, I never registered in my head anyway, so it's not in my menu. But yeah. What I'm asking is, can TFE negative status will rule it out? So it seems to be all cases are diffusely positive for TFE3. So say some case that we suspect that, but it's totally negative, can we rule that out? The sensitivity is good enough to rule it out?
Yeah, I don't know. They didn't really, if it's in the discussion, I mean, it may be in the discussion, and I would just have to look at the paper, Joanne. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, I'll look into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That way we don't have to do the molecular study, you know, maybe a kind of cleaner for.
Yeah, I don't know how, I mean, I don't know how specific that is, as Jen was saying. All right, quickly, this paper I think ended up in the folder for discussion cases, because I originally thought I was maybe going to discuss it and then I didn't. But at the recent thoracic meeting that many of us were at in Budapest, András's course, Dr. Aziza Nassar presented on SMARCA4 deficient non-small cell carcinomas. And, you know, throughout her entire talk, I was scratching my head because I thought, you know, those were all sort of incorporated now into the SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated thoracic tumor. Well, it turns out that I was wrong. And in fact, last month, another article which wasn't discussed but was listed in the journal club was this article by Velut. And so both of these talk about SMARCA4 deficient non-small cell lung carcinomas. And, you know, I reached out to Anya and Jen, and these tumors that they're describing, from what I can understand, are really tumors that look like ordinary carcinomas, squamous, mostly adenos, but that, you know, during the workup, maybe you do molecular on them and they're found to actually have a SMARCA4 deficiency. So they look like garden variety carcinomas, but they have, you know, these molecular abnormalities. So the tumors in their group, also in both of these studies, the tumors appear to have a high density of neutrophils. They also have other targetable mutations, including KRAS, G12C, and MET amplification. So, you know, according to Jen and Anya, maybe the SMARCA4 loss is a passenger mutation. These are not my words. I copied these from the email from Jen. And maybe are not a strong oncogenic driver for the tumor. But anyway, you know, just be aware that these tumors are out there, and that was something new to me. Any other comments from anybody on this?
Do we need to look for SMARCA4, whether it's intact or not, in every tumor then?
I mean, I would say no.
I don't think so.
But what I would be curious is actually if they have a kind of equal worse outcome than the other carcinomas without the BRG1 loss or not. Because I kind of vaguely remember, I think there was a study which showed that they don't have as bad as an outcome as the SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumors, but I can't really exactly remember. And I don't think it has been greatly studied.
Yeah, Anya, that's my recollection too, that they have a poor prognosis among non-small cell lung cancers, but not as bad as the SMARCA4 deficient undifferentiated tumors.
So I vaguely remember Natasha Reckman's paper. I think, and I listened to her talk, and I think she published subsequently. So according to her paper, you know, it's kind of nebulous thing, maybe a passenger mutation, as Jen said. So something, you know, we shouldn't look for really, because it doesn't do anything. So like, you know, neuroendocrine markers, any given non-small cell carcinoma, you may see something that doesn't do anything for, you know, tumor behavior, something similar, you know? So my understanding, I have to double check, but the Natasha's work, I think that was the conclusion, but I have to double check. Maybe you can look up her paper.
Is this molecular alteration tested in common molecular profiling like Foundation One or?
I don't don't know. I don't know for that.
Because then basically all of our advanced lung tumor cases are tested in some shape or form. So it would be easy to look at SMARC A4 in those cases.
Yeah.
So SMARC A4 normally are included in larger panels, both our in-house MCSTP and the commercial labs. Those like 400-500 genes, normally they will cover SMARC A4. So it's not uncommon that we see like those like canonical non-small cell that have a point mutation in SMARC A4 occasionally, but for the morphology doesn't fit, and sometimes the IHC even intact, seeing one allele of a missense mutation doesn't mean that tumor is a SMARC A4 deficient undifferentiated thoracic tumor. So I think that's because now we sequence more, we found some of those and become those passenger mutation got mixed into the primary SMARC A4 deficient tumor.
Yeah. Well, it's good to know that. Thanks, Ying Chun, for that. All right. Well, we're at 7:02. Good discussion. Thanks, everybody. Sorry about the change in date. Appreciate the fact that you all showed up anyway. So thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Harry.
Thank you. Yeah.